My name is Lisa Smith. I'm 50 years old, and I've brought my sister with me to Grand Central Station in New York City to interview her today.
My name's Debbie Smith. I'm 57 years old, and my sister's going to talk to me, and it is February 18th, 2006.
Debbie, I asked you to come to StoryCorps because you've made some amazing and interesting choices in your life. And I think that I want to know a little more about them than I've ever asked you before. Tell me, what experience led you to decide to apply to the Peace Corps?
I think it came from our home. All the years that people came to our house from many different parts of the world. And Dad, as the chaplain at Colgate University, had people that came from many, many different places. And I remember in particular the reincarnations of the Dalai Lama, the little boys from Tibet, who stayed up at Chapel House, who would talk, would come and would play with us, especially you and Brian. People came to our house from many different places. And probably the most impressive was that there was a guy who was on the political science department who was a single professor up at Colgate. And he invited many of the freedom fighters in the late 50s to come to our house after they had given lectures at Colgate. And I was a little girl. I was a very little girl. And he didn't have any place to have the receptions after the lectures. And so he would have them come down to our house to have the receptions afterwards. And I didn't have to go to the old, long, boring lectures, but when all those interesting, exciting people came, I would be sitting up at the top of the stairs listening. And so I think that that was how my interest in Africa developed early. And I think that that was one of the motivations in terms of applying to Peace Corps, because I wanted to go to Africa. And that's one of the reasons why I got involved in learning French, because I knew that Africa was Francophone as well as Anglophone. And one of my earliest strong memories of television was in 1960, when the United Nations, they were showing the meeting where so many of the African countries were becoming members of the United Nations after having become independent, on most of them on July 1st. So this was, must have been early July. And I went, that's a whole new part of the world that is opening up. And I want to know more about that. I want to be a specialist in that area, because I was kind of looking for, you know, what was I going to do with my life at that particular time? So that was really important. And unfortunately, I can't think of the name of the professor at this point. Anyway, he ended up in California.
When you applied to the Peace Corps, what kind of choices did you have about where you wanted to go? Could you choose Africa or a given country?
I don't remember all of the details. I know that you did have some choice. I know that because I knew some French, that they were able to have me chosen primarily for French-speaking countries. They do wonderful jobs with language instruction, but still, when they have someone who already has some background, I think that there's a preference in that direction. I was supposed to go to Senegal, and it was only changed at the very last moment. And I don't know exactly why that happened. So I think that it's a combination of what you have to bring to it and the other way. I think what the needs are of Peace Corps and what the circumstances are in terms of how many people they need where. Also, I know that sometimes Peace Corps wants specialists and sometimes they want generalists. And it's sort of like a pendulum that goes from one extreme to the other. And my Master of Arts in Teaching was one of the reasons why I was selected to be a teacher. And because I had the master's already, was one of the reasons why I taught at a university level rather than a secondary level school.
You went to Upper Volta, what was then called Upper Volta and is now called Burkina Faso. Mm-hmm. Did you know anything about Upper Volta before you went there? And what was it like to land there unprepared?
Well, one of the interesting things was that not that many years before, when I was a sophomore in college, Carol Casey and I were both living abroad on the junior abroad program in Geneva, Switzerland. And we shared a room in an apartment in Geneva, Switzerland. And one of the things that we had on our wall was a map of Africa. And I was doing some studying at the African Institute in Carouge, which is outside of Geneva. And that's one of the reasons we had the map. And we would look at the map and decide where we would be in the number of years later. And one of the places that we found on the map was this interesting sounding place, Ouagadougou, which I found out later was Ouagadougou.
And the capital of Upper Volta.
The capital of Upper Volta. I said, that's where I'm going to be. And she decided that she would be in Washington, D.C., and that's where she ended up later as well. And so at the African Institute, I was able to study some about Africa in general, and especially Francophone Africa. My specialty was related to Cameroon. And so I knew something about French colonialism, and Upper Volta was a colony of France. I didn't have any sense of what the Sahel and the Sahelian climate was going to be like in some of those things. We arrived in July. We had had just a weekend in Philadelphia before, where we were having some orientation, and there were a number of volunteers who had come back from Burkina Faso to tell us about what life was going to be like and things like that. So it was a very exciting time to meet a lot of new people and all this sort of stuff. There were almost 100 volunteers at that time who were going to Burkina Faso at that time. And they showed us some slides, and I remember vividly, as they showed us each of these slides that came along, there would be trees, beautiful trees. And I was just struck because I was expecting that this was a desert or a near desert. And I thought, and I go, oh, wow, what kind of a tree is that? And it's a, that's an African tree. And then I see the next, what kind of a tree is that? It's an African tree. So we had experience and we had expectations, and I knew more perhaps than a lot of other people that were becoming volunteers for the first time, because I had studied Africa. And I had some teaching experience, but we had teaching English as a foreign language training while we were there, as well as language training when we first arrived. So,
what was the most memorable thing about your Peace Corps experience?
Falling in love.
And what do you carry from that?
The humanity of all people, I think. It was a magical time because it was during the first training period. When we first arrived, after we first arrived, I think we had 6 weeks of training. And it was only the first 2 or 3 weeks that we were there that my teacher of More, which is the local language in Ouagadougou, was very special to me. And he just sparkled, and we made a connection very quickly. And everyone was new to everyone, all the volunteers to each other. And it was a new place. We were all living on a girls' school in the summertime, and it was very intensive training. And so there were lots of sparks going off in all kinds of directions in terms of personal relationships. And we made a very strong relationship, which continued during the entire time that I was there. But it was short-lived in a way, because after the first 3 weeks, then the last 3 weeks of my training were in Niger. So even though it started, it was also, there was the beginning, the arrival, and then there was the departure, and then we came back. And so I think that comings and goings had a lot to do with that. What I take from the entire Peace Corps experience, I think, is the dynamic energy of Americans really wanting to make life better for ordinary people very far around the world. And a kind of innocence and a real joy, I think, on the part of many of the volunteers.
Including you?
Yeah.
Years after you were in the Peace Corps, you went back to Africa as a Fulbright teaching fellow, going to Bujumbura. Tell me what it was like to go back, and what drew you back to Africa?
Well, it wasn't so very long, really. I mean, 70s. I went back in 79, and so it was only four years or so. And it was the personal relationship with Jean-Baptiste, which was extremely important to me. And so I was seeking a way to be able to return, especially to Ouagadougou, to Burkina Faso. It wasn't yet that. It was still La Haute Volta. And so one of the possibilities was as a Fulbright professor, and I had known the person who was the Fulbright professor when I was there and was very excited by the kind of program that she was doing. And so I applied for a Fulbright. But at that time, I knew that she was continuing in the same position. So that particular Fulbright professorship was not available. So then other ones were available, and you applied to the whole program. And they offered me two possibilities, one of them in Somalia and the other one in Burundi. And because I had studied Cameroon, which is one of the mandates and later one of the trusteeship territories, and Burundi was also within that system, those two countries had a lot of similarities, so I knew something about Burundi, and I didn't know very much about Somalia, so I chose Burundi.
Would you recommend the Peace Corps or some other similar international program to children, to young people that you know? Would you recommend it to your 18-year-old son?
Absolutely. And I think that, once again, I would say because of the humanity, that all people are people. And also because I think that it allows you to make contact with many other Americans who have a similar kind of vivaciousness, a similar kind of hope, a similar kind of belief in the importance of reaching out to other people around the world. I think it would be an excellent kind of thing. Not only because you're reaching out and beginning to understand another culture and another way of life and meeting and dealing with a lot of challenges, but also because of the Americans that you meet within that context as well.
You ultimately settled for a good period of time in Burundi and had a new love there. What held you in Africa and in Burundi in particular? And what drew you to keep going back?
Well, I had applied for a Fulbright, and the possibility was in Burundi. And it's partly because you can do important work. both Burkina Faso and Burundi are relatively small populations, especially of the educated part of the population, and yet they are very much an international microcosm. So you get the opportunity to know many people and know many nationalities and interact in a really international kind of way, which very often isn't the case in the United States. And right now, I'm teaching French at an American high school. Most of the kids don't want to use French, learn French, and they don't think that they'll ever use French in their futures. Nonetheless, I tell them that it's quite possible. But when I taught in Burundi for 3 years at the University of Burundi as a Fulbright scholar, when I returned to Burundi later, I met people in many different institutions, at the airport, at the banks, at the customs office. At every place that I went, I saw former students. And when I finally returned, when I finally left Burundi in 94, I was working for UNICEF for a very short time. I went up country, so I wasn't even in the capital city. And every place that I went, I had met someone who was a former student of mine. And so you feel like you have an impact on a whole country. And I don't think that I can do that in the same way in the United States. I'd never helped anybody as much as I wanted to, but I think it's worth doing.
I want to move to your experiences as a mother. Your 18-year-old son, Robert, is my nephew and godson. Can you describe the moment when you saw him for the very first time?
I remember things about that time, but I don't know that I can pinpoint that particular moment. And maybe that's another one of those funny things or odd things where I remember wanting to reach out to the level of our mother's experience. Because childbirth was so important to her. And I really wanted to have natural childbirth. I really wanted to nurse. And neither of those things were possible. And I remember her talking about the explosion of love that she felt the very moment that she first gave birth. And that was just so amazing to me. I remember holding him that night, but I don't remember the first moment. I remember during the cesarean section when Dad was right there in the room, and when he was taken from my body and they were checking him out over and that things were all right. And I remember that very vividly. And I remember later when Carol Harmon was in the room and rocking Robert. And I remember that very, very vividly. But the first moment of seeing him somehow isn't quite there in the same way.
Tell me about Robert's name and the meanings that go with his name.
It's a passing on. Robert has three names. Robert, Dukundane, Bikwemu. And his first name is from his grandfather.
Who we know as Robert.
And his last name is from his grandfather. Our dad is Bob Smith, Robert V. Smith. And so I wanted to honor him. And I felt that Robert was a good name. And I felt that it was a more interesting name as Robert, and because we were living in a French-speaking country, and I wanted to choose a name for him that he could use in either an English-speaking country or in a French-speaking country that he could use using the French pronunciation Robert or Robert or Bob or Bobby or whatever he wanted at any other time. And I thought that there was some freedom allowed in that first name. And I guess I'm pretty pleased that he's chosen to keep it Robert. And when he's called in a doctor's office by the nurse or something and they call for Robert, very often he'll say, Robert, my name is Robert. Although sometimes we get Robert too. And then his last name is Biquemo, and that comes from his grandfather. My husband, Robert's dad, was Bernard Sindaihiura. And I thought that Sindaihiura was a pretty long, difficult name for someone to have to deal with in the United States, because it's got a lot of syllables and it's just long. For a Burundian name, it's relatively short, but that's okay. So instead of using his father's last name, instead to use his grandfather's name. And actually, Bernard was known as Biquemo or Biquet most of his life, because his father was important and because all of his younger brothers used Biquemo as a last name. So I thought that we were honoring both families with the first name and the last name. And then, of course, the magic is Dukundani, which means we love each other.
Robert's father, your husband Bernard, very tragically died of malaria when Robert was 6 or 7?
7 and a half.
What favorite story about Bernard would you like to memorialize for Robert?
Robert was very special to Bernard, and he liked to have Robert go with him places. And we have photographs showing that he's come by the house and picked up Robert and might have Belize along with him. And they might have gone in the back of the pickup truck probably on a Saturday or a Sunday when Bernard was working. And they go to the bank, the National Bank of Burundi, where he worked. And one of his jobs, he had lots of different jobs, was to pick up the shredded paper of different kinds of things related to bank matters and take it to the dump. And so the kids would get in the front of the cab with Bernard, and then they'd be full of all of the papers and things. I never went on these trips, but he would take Robert and Belize, and they would go off together. And the fact that Bernard really enjoyed this, and this would have been when Robert was 2 and 3 years old, and Belize the same age, and they would go to the bank, and later Bernard took him into the bank I think it was sort of a coffee shop kind of thing, a commissary sort of place where he went with his daddy and got to see where he worked and things and enjoyed that kind of thing. And so I think the fact that Robert was very much a part of his work was very important. And then, of course, on the basketball court where he would lift Robert up so that he could make a basket when he was just very little. That was special.
Do you have any favorite stories from your own childhood?
Oh, okay. One of my favorites comes from when I was really little. Probably before you were born, maybe, or just after. One of the summers at Saranac, and I guess there were only two of them, but it seems like it went on forever and ever and ever. Dad managed the Colgate camp on Saranac Lake, Upper Saranac, and we were there in the summertime. And one of the things that he did was he called square dances. And we went down to, I can't remember what the name of the campsite was. It was one of the state parks nearby. And he would go and call square dances. And I was four or five. So you weren't born yet. I guess Brian was the baby that was in the
our brother camp. Brian.
Yeah, he was the one that was the baby. And I would get to go along sometimes. And so I would go down to the campground with him. And he would be calling the squares. And then I remember this once, but I have a feeling that it happened more than once. He would stop and say to everybody, "Oh, none of you know how to really swing. Let me show you how to swing." And he would take me and show them how to swing. And there's nothing like that. And, of course, you know that Dad was a great, great square dance caller and enjoyed that in a lot of different formats. So that's probably one of them. And standing next to him at the chapel when he would have preached on the Sunday morning. And he would be shaking hands with everyone as they left the chapel, and I had a chance to stand next to him and shake people's hands, too. I like to feel important next to my daddy, because he was important, too.
Were there any experiences in your own college years that you would like to pass along to your son as he approaches college?
Interesting. I worked hard. I get the feeling that from looking at the way that colleges are experienced these days by young people, that at least for a lot of students, it's sort of fun and games, and the classes are sort of incidental. And when I was at Smith College, we took them fairly seriously. And so we pretty much worked all day long. And partly because of the house system, because we all met together and had dinner together and happened to speak French at meals at the French house. It was a small group of people. There were only 30 students. And almost everybody came back for dinner every time there rather than a general cafeteria situation. And then after coffee in the front room, almost all of us went to the library. And most of us were using the required readings that we had to get in the reserve room. And so that was the place where pretty much everybody was. And it was like a study hall. I mean, that doesn't help him in terms of what he's going to do in the future, but we worked. And we had a good time. We really partied too, but we really worked. And I get the sense for Robert that that's his intention. And it can be easier or more difficult depending on the context. And my sense is that these days it may be harder to be serious than it was in the past.
Tell me about your experience in Mississippi in the summer during the civil rights struggle. What summer was that?
It was the first summer after my freshman year. So the summer of 67.
Where were you in Mississippi?
I was Mary Holmes Junior College in West Point, Mississippi, which is in the northern part of Mississippi. It was part of the Office of Economic Opportunity program. The Johnson effort to end poverty. And it started, where it started is a little bit difficult to explain. I was at Smith College, and one of the lawyers for the NAACP came and spoke at Smith College, and she was looking for a number of students to help with a program to help to integrate Mississippi schools. Well, integrate is perhaps too strong a way of explaining the whole thing. The idea was that the NAACP was bringing suits to try to force integration or to end segregation in Mississippi schools, and the Mississippi legislature had come up with this idea of a freedom of choice plan so that parents would decide which schools their children should go to. Clearly, you had to choose either a formerly black school, all black school, or formerly all white school, and parents knew which school their kids were supposed to go to. And most parents chose the formerly all black school if they were black. But the minority, a very small minority, had chosen and consciously chosen to go to the white schools. As a result of that, many of them were in court cases and spent a lot of time doing that. This had all taken place the year before our program, and the students, many of them, were not excelling in their new schools. As a matter of fact, many of them were not passing. And so the idea was to provide a summer program where students received extra help in basic courses and tutoring. And I was a tutor that summer, and it was to help them to be able to do better and to be successful in the integrated schools, to show that integrated schools could work, and to support the efforts to integrate more fully. And it was called the Tougaloo Summer Enrichment Program. And the theory was that it was going to be in Tougaloo, which is the capital, but they didn't have it there because the senator wouldn't allow it to be there, for the Mississippi senators. So we had it outside of the capital city. So it was a little bit away from where it would be more obvious. And it was a very important summer for me personally. And I think that it was interesting. They had classes in the morning. The tutors supported a small group, 7 or 8 students from the same county that were in these classes. We lived all on the campus of this junior college. And then in the afternoons, right after lunch, they had the groups meet as county groups, and they were meeting with psychologists and sociologists about the impact that this had on the group of students as they moved from one kind of schooling to another. And then we had tutorial and various other kinds of programs in the afternoon, and games and sports and that kind of thing. And I remember especially that we went to a swimming pool. It was not the swimming pool right there in the town, because they had closed that one in order not to integrate it. But we went someplace else where I think that swimming was very important in terms of people just sharing and being free and easy with one another and playing in the water. I think that was very important. One time we went to the movie theater in town, and we unwittingly integrated the place because we all went upstairs. And one time there was one boy who had a toothache, and I had to take him to the dentist. And I took him, and we went to the dentist, and we went in the front door. And then I was whispered to that, no, that wasn't the place to go. We had to go around the back alley.
Because it was a black student.
It was a black student. And we went in the back alley, and it was clear that the dental chair was the one that had been rejected and had been used long before. And that spoke more to me of the injustice of segregation more powerfully than almost anything else, that it's the small things, that the small humiliations that speak to the inhumanity of one person to another. And probably that had a lot to do with wanting to reach out one way or another to human beings as human beings, no matter where they lived.
Okay, your turn. Any questions that you've never asked me that you'd like to know about?
I didn't think of this and I didn't plan it. Tell me about the experience of having a child of your own and having an adopted child, and the joys and challenges of that.
My son, JT, is 9 years old, and he was born 10 weeks prematurely. And during especially the first 5 months of his life, he gave us quite a number of scares, had some significant breathing problems. And my wonderful, supportive husband was there with me to face those challenges every step of the way. The first couple of years were difficult. And for a time, as I think many parents feel, we thought, we're never doing this again. We don't need any more children. One is good. But as you mentioned earlier, we had a mother who really celebrated birth and family and children. And I think, although my husband and I had married somewhat later in life, at 39, we did want to have another child. We wanted to feel that there was some balance. And I think we also recognized that because of the challenges that our son had had, it was awfully easy to spoil him, to give in to him. Having another child would help to balance that. And so with the incredible support of our dear friends Tony and Sylvia, who are our daughter's godparents and who themselves are adoptive parents, we started the process of trying to adopt. And from the very beginning, we said, doesn't matter to us if this child is white, black, purple, or green polka dotted. We wanted to have a child that we could love and care about. And because your son, my nephew and godson, is biracial, we felt that there were no limits from our own experience of what we had seen both in our family and in the world, that those kinds of labels were not the important thing. And so we waited, as most prospective adoptive parents do, and finally got the call that there was a baby girl available for us. And she is now six, Kinsey Rose. Rose coming from our mother's name, Rosalind. And there are some challenges that go along with that. She is in a school that is mostly white, and she is a beautiful milk chocolate brown, and she is more conscious of her color than everyone else in the family, and I don't think that's a particular surprise. She's the one who has to live with it. And so we have to encourage and support her in dealing with being different and in reminding her that we are all different in one way or another. It's just that her difference is a bit more obvious, perhaps. She's very conscious of not having been born from my body in the way that her brother was. And every once in a while, her older brother says, I wish you'd never gotten her, but I don't think that's anything other than normal sibling rivalry. I think adoption is an extraordinary process for creating a family, that there's no perfect way to create a family. And every family is unique, has its own challenges and joys and sorrows, as does ours.
Well, JT's a miracle baby, and so is Kinsey.
We have both of our miracle children that make our family complete. Any last words that you want to add to your StoryCorps interview?
I want to say thank you to my sister, who is very special to me.
This was a great experience. Thank you.